So Kazra Farhani, I have to tell you that we've talked before for Loki. I love retrofuturism. I love the look and feel of this. I was talking to Scott, the VFX supervisor, last week, and I told him when I sat down to watch this movie, I had this massive smile on my face for like 45 minutes just because the world, the characters, everything was exactly as I imagined it would be. And part of that is due to you, the production design. I absolutely love your work. And you were, I mean, it's brilliant what you've done here. And I can't wait to talk to you about it.
Thank you so much. That's really kind of you. I'm excited to talk about it too.
So you were Emmy nominated for your work on Loki. And now you're back with, you know, retrofuturism, but in a slightly different way than what you've employed on Loki. Loki was inspired by 1950s. And we're a little bit later into, you know, into the 60s, early 60s, late 50s, early 60s for what you've got here with Fantastic Four. What drove your initial concepts for the design of the film?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was interesting when my phone rang for this job because I immediately thought mid-century retrofuturism is something I've done a lot already in Loki. But after like looking more into the source material, which admittedly I didn't know very much about, I didn't grow up reading Fantastic Four. I realized it was very different, and that Loki, especially, you know, we were going after like a sort of feel of an ominous Orwellian monolith. So for that, we were looking a lot at European style mid-century modernism, brutalism, and these heavy concrete, stoic spaces. And it was clear than the source material for Fantastic Four that this was like something very different. It's about optimism first and foremost, and about dynamism and acceleration and forward movement. And so it became very clear that it was a completely different thing, you know. And then early in conversations with Matt Shakman, the director, he just doubled down on that his primary interests were the optimism of the Jet Age and that period, and like all the hope we had at the time when the kind of Apollo programs were getting traction and people were covering new ground in terms of space exploration. And that technology was informing, to a degree, informing the practical world of people's lives, but to a great degree informing the aesthetic of product design and architecture and all of and fashion and all of those things were deeply influenced by that in that era. And we wanted to like take that and run with it and take the idea that all those things, all that inspiration that showed up in our actual world showed up as like pulp art and comics and, aspirational imagery in this world of the film was going to be manifest. It was going to be real. We're going to actually exist in this world because of the birth of this key figure, Reed Richards. All that tech came to pass.
So I read that you sought another inspiration from another World's Fair, which Loki we talked about, 1894 World's Fair of 1893. Yeah. But you also interacted with or looked at the 1964 World's Fair in New York, and that makes sense because that's where Walt Disney had Carousel of Progress. It's where he had It's a Small World, optimism, hope, new style. You know, tell me about that relationship to that World's Fair.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like the 1964 World's Fair is like an amazing collection of all of this, all of these ideas manifested on a very, very large scale, on an architectural scale. And, considering the amalgamation of all the pavilions and stuff, it looked like a small city from the future. Mm-hmm. And absolutely that period, you know, whether you're looking at the Jetsons or you're looking at the World's Fair or you're looking at automobile design from that period, it's undeniable that they're all looking to the jet age and space flight as this kind of source inspiration for all of that and trying to capture the optimism and hope and kind of sense of awe that those things had in society and distill it into ordinary products that people can buy. And that's what the World's Fair is, like pavilions from different corporations, from, General Motors to Coca-Cola to, Dow Chemical to what have you. All of them are trying to like take that undeniable, palpable spirit of optimism the era had and funnel it into the new products that they're bringing into the world.
So it's interesting you talk about the Jetsons, because I, you know, as I remember, it's been a long, long time since I've seen the Jetsons, obviously, but what I remember of that was so many of their structures had these perfectly rounded edges. It didn't seem like there were that many like straight lines in there. And then I go back and look after a rewatch of Fantastic Four First Steps, when you go to the Richards apartment, there are the counters have those wavy lines. There are domes and you know, arcs within the architecture. Was that is that a hallmark of mid-century modern? Is that what were you picking up on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that like for me, undeniably, the two key sources of inspiration for the look of the world of Reed Richards, right? This is because, you know, it's worth going back and saying that the primary difference between the mid-century America in Fantastic Four First Steps and the mid-century America that actually transpired, from our point of view as the filmmaking team, the narrative inflection point was the birth of Reed Richards. That when this guy was born, this Oppenheimer meets Da Vinci type figure was born, the world's, the timeline forked. And so if you imagine that he's in his mid-30s and the mid-60s, he's probably born sometime around 1930. You figure as he comes into adulthood or approaches it somewhere around 1950, that's when his influence, the influence of his brilliant innovations, his ideas, the technology that he's created starts to seep into the world. So based on that, we thought like everything, you know, everything prior to 1950 looks exactly the same as it does in our New York, you know, but things that were built after 1950 start to take on his DNA. And so it became, the exercise was about defining what is his DNA? What does it look like? And for me, this is a roundabout answer to your question, but for me, the architecture of Eero Saarinen and Oscar Niemeyer became the kind of lighthouses for me of what Reed Richards' aesthetic vernacular was. Mm-hmm. And that's relevant to your question in the sense that, like, I think so much of what was done in the Jetsons was, you know, there's so many buildings that you see in the Jetsons and they repeat these shapes that look like, for instance, the TWA Flight Center, Saarinen's TWA Flight Center, you know. There's a beautiful conch-shaped building I saw in the Jetsons that looked like a beautiful Williams Route 66 roadside motel. The difference between the Jetsons and super elegant finesse architecture is just proportions. It's the amount of whimsy versus elegance. There's a spectrum of whimsy to kind of elegance or refinement, if you want to call it. And Jetsons is one at one end, and you know, Niemeyer and Saarinen and Williams, all these other guys are at the other end. And it's just like, where do you want to fall on that? And we made the choice to fall as close as we could to the sophisticated end of that, you know, where the retrofuturism is there. It's undeniable. It's in the curves and the accelerating curves and in the like monolithic white surfaces. The fact that, as you point out, there are no straight lines in the set. But we pulled away from some of the kind of more zany, silly parts of retrofuturism. You know, we have the fins, we have the chrome, we have the bullet tips, but they're used where you need them. It's not wallpapered on everything, which is, I think, the distinction between that early retrofuturism and the more kind of refined version of it.
That's interesting that you mentioned the you know, pulling away from the zaniness, because one thing that I do think is a hallmark of First Steps is this delicate balance between a wink and a nudge and, you know, oh, this is funny, look at this, what we've got going on here, and being 100% serious and playing it very realistic and very, you know, this is a practical world that we are creating, and we are not doing this as a satire or parody, that this is, you know, it is playful, but it is also, you know, no, we have a full library. We've got a lookbook going, you know, all of that. There's a balance. Talk about the balance between that sort of playfulness and an actual sort of serious intended design.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think by and large, we were we were, the default was the latter, right? The default was the, like, we want to make something super elegant and beautiful that captures the spirit and the optimism, the aspiration kind of towards a utopia that was driving all the designers and artists of the mid-century when they made those images and they made those illustrations. We wanted to like give them that in the sense of bringing that world to life. So everything looks super elegant, like the world's, I think a lot of the World's Fair stuff was that. But we also needed to find the moments to really put you know, a bell on the retrofuturistic ideas that we wanted to get across. So a good example of this is like the Fantasticar. So the Fantasticar was designed and built completely from scratch, inspired a lot by the Firebird 4 concept car, which was like a beautiful, almost European looking sports car with elegant sweeping curves and understated small scale details, but undeniably had the curves and the lines of that period, that energy. So we took a lot of inspiration from that. But what we knew we needed to do is we needed to look earlier, like at the Ford Atlas from the 50s, to bring in some of these bullet tips and these turbines and some of these like chrome accent lines that are like quintessentially, you know, they're just essential to telling the story of the retrofuturistic thing. So we have this largely uninterrupted, sweeping, monolithic form for the Fantasticar, but you look at the front and the back and you have those bullet tips and those turbines. You're ticking those boxes. Another example is the Excelsior rocket ship. So, you know, the Excelsior rocket ship is the curves that are there are inspired by Brasilia, Niemeyer's Brasilia. Those sort of like, you know, there's no radial arcs anywhere. Everything's an accelerating kind of parabolic curve. And yet we knew that like this was a big icon that also needed to tell that story quickly. At a quick read, we needed to see retrofuturism there. And so we looked at like 50s versions of rockets that had these like outriggers with boosters on them. So, you know, the silhouette at a glance is immediately retrofuturistic. But as you get closer to it, you start to see that it's quite refined in the form language. At least that's what I hope. So that's the kind of example of the push and pull between the elevated version of retrofuturism and the like archetypical version of retrofuturism that you need for quick storytelling.
A few minutes ago, you described sort of the creation of this world as that moment where Reed Richards is born. It kind of, an incursion happens, if we're going to throw back to some Loki terminology there. I think that's what, a variant is alternate timeline is created essentially.
Yeah.
And then he starts to modify his world based on his designs as Da Vinci would have if Da Vinci were born in the 1930s. But when Ben Grimm, the Thing, you know, ventures outside, he's in more traditional New York style boroughs. Is that because those you envision that those structures were created in advance of Reed Richards' ascend, essentially?
So Ben hails from Yancey Street, which is the Lower East Side. You know, it's inspired by Delancey Street. And the idea, this was true in the mid-century, is that like that part of Manhattan was less encroached upon by modernity, you know? And like we also wanted to create that contrast between, you know, we built a massive Times Square, and we also built the Lower East Side, and we wanted them to feel quite different. Like Times Square is all about this retrofuturism, you know, the silvers and the blues and the concrete and the glass. Whereas like Yancey Street, where Ben Grimm is from and where he still goes to root himself emotionally, to ground himself, to buy the cookies at Maisie's that he grew up eating, has a palette more like a Hopper painting, where it's these earth tones and this rusts and ochres and this warm and nostalgic sort of palette. And everybody knows each other and they call out to each other. Also, it's a multicultural neighborhood, which tells the story of New York. And so you won't see retrofuturism in Yancey Street. However, if you look over those, you know, four-story, five-story buildings, apartment buildings, into the adjacent neighborhoods, you will start to see these parabolic you know, structures of the monorail and the spires, optimistic spires that are telltale of the rest of Retrofuture New York. It's just that we wanted Yancey Street to feel like this cozy little sort of hamlet that had been forgotten, or at least had not yet been modernized in that way, and they're quite happy with their life as it is there.
Yeah. And then you look at, you know, when you broaden outside of that neighborhood and you go into places like the UN building and other areas, they do take on that more optimistic future, you know, retrofuturism, 1964, whatever you want to call it. I'm even thinking about the, I think it's an airport in DC, but it's an airport that Spielberg used for Catch Me If You Can.
Dulles.
Yeah, yeah. It has that Saarinen. Same. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a Saarinen airport. Yeah.
So what other buildings inspired the way that you realized, you know, like the UN, for example?
Sure. I mean, so the UN is, you know, had three architects, but Oscar Niemeyer was one of them, you know, and Dulles that you point out was Eero Saarinen. So it really is those guys, you know, like Brasilia is a massive influence on the Niemeyer side. The UN was an influence. And the Niemeyer side. Also, the Communist Party headquarters in Paris, France was a big influence, which was a Niemeyer building. It had beautiful interior details that inspired the sort of coved stairs that we did inside the conversation pit inside the Baxter building. And on the Saarinen side, yeah, the TWA Flight Center was a big influence. That building itself looks like it could take flight at any moment. Dulles Airport was a big influence. The St. Louis Arch, which Saarinen designed, was a big influence. You know, that beautiful parabolic shape inspired a lot of things for us. So, you know, there are other architects that were relevant, but honestly, the body of work from those two guys, which to me, I feel like they really talked to each other and just seemed like the essence of Reed Richards' language. You know, on a interior design standpoint, you know, Saarinen was also relevant because he did so much furniture design. But like when you start to look at the technology inside the Fantasticar, inside the Excelsior cockpit, and inside the Reed's lab, there's a very specific vernacular that you'll see there. And that is this vernacular of the era, which is this like, monolithic fiberglass workstations where everything, the monitors and the keyboards and all that are like, seem to be made out of one giant piece of fiberglass, which was a thing that they really thought that's where the future was at some point there. And Luigi Colani was a designer that I was very interested in at that point, because he tried to make everything out of a single piece of fiberglass. And then we contrasted that kind of super whimsical form language with very rigid typography on those interfaces, sort of inspired by Dieter Rams, the German designer, very rigid. So it's like you have this flowing form and then you contrast it with very down to business, like nomenclature on the workstations.
It's probably similar inspirations, but I'm as you're talking about, as you're describing, the image that comes to mind, I don't know if you've seen this, but is Inside Out, the Pixar film, where control panel. And it is this whole thing that kind of just, it's one solid sort of fiberglass looking thing, but then they all have the very specific little functions buttons on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, you'll see it in the Jetsons as well, you know, where it's like this big swooping surface and it's just arrayed with controls. And I think that's part of the period, you know, it's part of what their kind of idea of the future was going to be.
Wildly different from the bureaucratic technology of the TVA in Loki.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So last question for you. My favorite design of yours in this film is I think it's what you call the conversation pit, but it's there. It's the den, essentially, where it has that circular chimney that goes all the way up through that cathedral ceiling. Gorgeous, gorgeous set. It's just absolutely beautifully designed. What is your favorite piece in the film?
Oh, so hard to choose among your children. I mean, I love that set. It was fantastic. The team did an amazing job on that. But gosh, it's a tough choice between the Excelsior and the Fantasticar. And maybe, I guess it would have to be Reed's Lab that is my favorite. You know, this sort of... It was really, I think, a treat to get to do that lab. Because the thing is, labs, any sort of sci-fi genre film usually has a lab in it. So it's something that's been done a lot of times. So it was a real challenge we set out for ourselves to find a lab that people could look at and be like, okay, I haven't seen that before. And that was really a pleasure. You know, like where labs are always these sort of dark spaces with stainless steel stuff and cyan bluish light, is that that's a trope. Like we wanted this to be something completely different, like this bright, optimistic sort of cathedral to science and to innovation. And so we created this like huge vaulted space, the ceilings. Also the idea there is that like this is within the Baxter building and he's doing sort of like, you know, risky experimentation in this space. It needed to feel like an absorptive sort of bunker-like space that could take the force of a blast of an experiment gone wrong. So that was another reason why we ended up with this vaulted thing, and we ended up with this sort of fluted, elaborate sort of absorptive texture in the ceiling. The ceiling, I'll talk about it for a minute, because it's like the ceiling and the walls were all unpainted plaster. They were all made out of plaster. Like we knew it was going to be white. We assumed we were going to paint it. But when the amazing plaster team showed me the first cast pieces of the ceilings, the texture was so beautiful. Like there's a quality that you get from the unpainted plaster that it's like a shimmering quality where there's like the high spots shine and the low spots fall into relief. And you can see the light like go into it and disperse. It has like a subtle glow and shimmer to it. That once I saw that, I knew we couldn't paint the surface. We had to like celebrate the skin of the plaster itself. So that entire space ended up being unpainted, that ceiling, which was a ton of work for the plasterers because that meant every joint had to be smooth with plaster. You couldn't spackle it and paint it. But the result is just the way that space takes light, I think, for me, really does start to take on some of the feeling of a cathedral or a devotional space. The other big kind of fun homage that we got to do in that space are the colored circles of, you know, that represent the organization of Reed's kind of mind and workflow, which were inspired by, of course, 2001, A Space Odyssey, for those colors. And, you know, we've got these three circles. There's the red area, which is when you first walk in, and that's sort of like the area for messy work, prototyping, electronics, robotics, welding, chemistry. When he's first figuring out something, that's where that happens. And then the next circle is the yellow area, which is space for contemplation and discussion, where he's got these big chalkboards and he's working problems out and thinking about them or bringing in the others for a meeting to discuss. That happens there. And then the blue area is the sort of mission control area. And that's where you start to see these like big Kalani-esque monolithic workstations where he's tons of computers monitoring space, monitoring the Excelsior systems, monitoring the Fantasticar systems, communicating with the rest of the world. All of those tasks are done there. So that's that. The lab, I guess, is probably my favorite because it had a huge number of new problems to solve, which were really fun to do.
Yeah, outstanding. Well, Kaz, you are brilliant at what you do, and this design is gorgeous. I'm a huge fan of it. Like I said, it was just I had to watch this film multiple times because I realized halfway through it that I was only engaging with it for on a production design level, and then I had to go back and kind of watch it for other things. So that's all because of your work. So thank you so much for the time.
That's kind of you to say. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.